It's I got it. Hang on. Which is absolutely dear to the heart of Jane and to myself, who have probably had as much groupiness and group experience as anybody I can think, certainly in terms of autogenic training. And I think universally we've absolutely loved it. And it's been a great richness in has been a great richness in my life. Not only the fact that one was delivering and sharing and teaching AT, which was a, like giving people a wonderful gift. It was also the enjoyment for yourself of seeing what happens to people and having the effect on yourself. And I love the group. It's a great source of nourishment and interest of behavior and all sorts of things. So Jane, shall I thought that if you've got the thing in front of you, could the thing that I wrote is a theoretical model, just the sort of theory. But as we're going along, obviously we're thinking about the 18 thing. So I think the thing to do is to sort of go through this, and we can all add our bit to the AT bit. Is that, do you think that's a good idea?
It is, and is this what you are referring to? Good.
Yes.
Cool.
Jane, I couldn't hear you. Are you on?
No, I'm unmuted now.
Oh.
Sorry, I'm only just printing the thing off. I'm so sorry. I had completely
Oh, that's
forgotten to
all right.
print
Well,
it.
I'll
So
start.
I just need to find the order of the pages now, and then I will be absolutely.
So shall I start?
Yes, do. Please
Yes,
do.
okay. So as I've said in the front piece, we're going to look at the group, the actual group, which is the people in it, the therapist, the person that, and the process. And looking at that in the theoretical model and also our own model. Here and Bev, have you got experience of groups?
Yeah, I
Yeah.
run them all the time. Yeah.
Yes, Bev?
And I love them.
Yeah.
Yes, in my previous career, I worked in training and it was group training, usually of IT systems. So,
Right, okay.
yeah,
So
not
you can,
therapeutically.
yes, you can actually comment on the group structure from your own experience, because that makes it all more interesting. So everybody chip in. Donna as well, because you're doing lots of groups now, aren't you?
I am loving
You
it.
are, yes. So the whole thing, I want this to be sort of all of us pooling our resources. So the group, so we start off with a group being a word for collections of people. And we just look at four we've got there, which is the network. And a network is a loose informal contact between people engaged in similar activities who have common interests. I think, Jane, you're part of a network, aren't you?
Well, if
You
you
were,
mean
you.
that I did used to go networking,
Yes, you
a
did.
networking group,
Yes,
yes.
I remember the network thing being associated. So, no concept of joining or leaving, and motivation is not important. So it's people who have a common interest, but they're not bound together. A group. So we move on to a group. People meeting together with a common objective. It needs time management and membership criteria, and some regulated factors to facilitate the common objective. Motivation is assumed, but vary from high to poor. So I think, are we looking here at the AT, the sort of AT group?
Yes.
Yes. So a team, we get to a team. Here the rules and regulations are paramount, and the team members achieve the best common purpose by adhering to the rules. Well, we've got sport, haven't we? We've got rules, we've got the rules of tennis, but I've just been listening to the last day of the test, which is very exciting. And there's all sorts of rules. There's one rule that's been really broken and all the rest of it. So rules and regulations and a team. And then we get on to a cult. And I think we have a sense of a cult. Highly regulated association of people who on entering are willing to sacrifice their individual needs to benefit from the philosophical aims of the organization. And the first thing that comes to mind to me is Plymouth, that I know of, is Plymouth Brethren and Jehovah's Witnesses. But those are the two that I've actually come across and know about. Any others? And then there have in America, there are cults, aren't there? There have been, there's been the Mormons and various cults. I think that's a bit more frequent in America. Anybody else got any cults that they know about? But you understand.
Scientology, like Scientology.
Yes. A bit looser than perhaps. Yes, you're right. It is actually, yeah. So
Oh, very
anyway,
much
there we
so.
are. So
I am thinking.
those is a sort of different way that people get together. And I think our AT is more of a group, we call it a group.
Well, I'm glad it's not a cult, Anne. Yeah. You're in now,
Yes.
Bev. There's no hope
But
for you. You're in. That's
yeah, yeah.
it.
But it's not a, but that there are aspects of the team which come and go. I mean, it isn't just hard and fast for each group. There are things that cross over. Anyway, that's probably enough of that. So we think AT is a group. So next, moving on to the size of the group. Now, apparently, research shows that the ideal size is between 5 and 10, with 7 or 8 being the optimum. So, Jane, that makes us think of the AT group, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I just inherited. No, actually, I didn't. No, I started with 6, right at the beginning, and then it sort of grew to 8. I'm not quite sure why. And I think you've got up to 10, haven't you?
Well, now it's actually an expedient number to do 10, to book 10, because with the fact that we're at the hospital and people have all sorts of other things getting in the way, and then there's life events and there's other things that stop them. So it's much better to overbook. And once, by mistake, I had 11 in a group, and I thought, well, never mind, I'll lose 3 of them. That'll be fine. I'll have 8. And all 11 went right through the whole course. And it
Yes.
was quite a challenge because, of
Yes,
course, we needed
and
time.
I would imagine that your relationship and the experience of yourself was different with 11 people
Yeah.
than it is with 5 or 6.
Yes.
It has to be.
However, having said that, it made everybody very disciplined. And there was a very different energy with having a
Yes,
really big
yes.
group. And it wasn't bad at all.
No. I would have
People
thought
got a lot out
much
of
more
it.
energy between the people because you've got more people there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what you do with more people is you lose perhaps intimacy,
Yeah.
one-to-one intimacy, or the ability for intimacy and one-to-one, and you have more actually interchange between the people. So when you move on to big figures, you are actually not having any intimacy at
At
all,
all, yeah,
and you're lecturing and giving
yes,
information. However, if you get down to a very small number, like 2 people, then the focus can be positive or negative, having 2. You certainly don't get the work of the group with 2 people.
no.
So that's the size of the group. Anybody do chip in if you want to say anything about that. The life of the group, long or short. So groups dealing with specific issues such as women's group, which would be a woman's group about, I don't know, the menopause, children or something. Relationship groups, which we know we have ma marital and relationship groups, addiction and support groups. So here the group members are homologous for some problem. So everybody coming to the thing has the same problem. Now, we sort of have that in the hospital, in the AT group, and sort of not, because it's homologous for the fact that you need to learn this technique. which is thought of as something that will release and relax and help stress and all the rest of it. But the people who are there are an absolute variety of absolutely anything. And the interesting thing about that is, although they have the homologous thing of they all need to have, want to have this thing to help their condition, their actual experience of the condition can be quite different.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, given the opportunity, members in the group can learn quite a bit about the different way that people experience their problems. And it's all a learning and sharing an experiential thing. So it's homologous in the AT group, but actually the variety is infinite.
It is. And actually, Nick Straton is starting to do some work particularly for autogenics and, can we remember, Donna? Is it, it's really with his musculoskeletal patients. So, well, I wouldn't say with chronic fatigue particularly, but let's say pain with his musculoskeletal patients. And I'm most interested to know how that is going, because of course that there is one thing, maybe you're going to come on to this, but if everybody is suffering from, shall we say, asthma, you will get the exchange going around with the group members on how they manage their asthma, and it actually becomes it actually narrows things down.
Well, I agree,
and I like I so I'm I agree. Intrigued to see how he gets on with that.
I can remember when Chris Perrin was starting and he was doing chronic fatigue. And I said, I advised him not to do chronic fatigue, but to have a variety of person. And again, I think we would learn, and Donna, we learn so much more. And people on the course learn so much more from everybody being different, because it means that your particular condition does not monopolize the actual discussion, but it can come up. And people can be interested in it. So, so a heterogeneous, not a homologous, so variety is much, much, much better. So your group needs effective time management. Well, we know about that. The reason for time management is that organizational. So that people know how long they're going to be there. If you're working, and if you're working either as a private therapist or within the organisation such as the NHS, there is a monetary thing about how long you're doing it, and there's also that time management actually does focus. I think both Pia and Bev have discovered that with their first. That wasn't a group, but the first thing is it's easy to go, and they wondered if they, and so we said, well, people need to know how long they're going to be there. And the cutoff means that perhaps you do perhaps concentrate your attention. So certainly, Donna and Janie, and I think we certainly are aware of time, although it goes very quickly.
Yes, well, you've got somebody hard on your heels to use the room.
Yes,
that's what happens now. So, so we're in a
especially with the 5:30 one.
Yes.
So that actually, probably if you had another half hour, the actual benefits of the whole practice would very, very little extra, very little extra.
Yeah. I'd agree.
I remember John Butler saying to me, remember John Butler?
Yeah.
And he did a group trainee assistantship. And he, I think he was a bit like the wise old owl. He didn't say very much, but he wrote the most fantastic report of it. Yeah. And in it, he said that, and he is a psychotherapist, and he said that he was, he remarked on the speed at which things happened, rather than in individual therapy, it was taking a lot more time. Mm-hmm. And as he says here, therapy is intended to set change in motion. And the benefits of this type of group that are restricted time can increase efficiency with heightened awareness and motivation. And I actually think that does happen with the time limit. However, if the interaction is very rapid, the group would be highly challenging to the therapist. You know, there is a balance, but I was quite John Butler was quite amazed at what happened without necessarily setting out to do it. Things happen, which of course is the tools that we are working with, and the energy of the group and the input of the group. So moving on, what the group has a right to expect. Consistency, fairness and honesty, recognition of worth, consideration and respect. Recognition is a really, really important word, because if we recognize something, it makes that something different if it's been recognized. And if it's not recognized, then it's a problem. It hasn't been brought to light. Recognition of people, recognition of anything, recognition of little trivial things, recognition of difficult things. The recognition means that it's actually being acknowledged. And acknowledgement is another important concept. New experiences, structure, directional boundaries. Boundaries, of course, being another very, very important word. Just at the moment, on the test match, Ben Stokes is sloshing things over the boundary and hitting sixes and fours. So when I use the word boundaries, I always think, because my dad used to take me to cricket matches, I always used to think of the boundary where the ball went over the boundary, and it was four. Anyway, so boundaries. Protection of standards, norms, values, and ethics. Feedback, yes. Interpretation, yes. Suggestions. A model of legitimate and compassionate authority. That's pretty highfalutin, isn't it? A model of legitimate and compassionate authority. That's really rather a laudable aim, isn't it? Oh, that's to the light. There we are.
Well,
okay, moving on.
Can I make a comment just about interpretation? Because I don't know that we do interpret or should interpret.
Well, we do to an point, just to a point.
To a point,
if,
yes. And
if,
we would ask
someone,
questions.
If someone came up and said,
yeah.
What was that? What was that? You would see what they think,
what,
and
yes.
Then perhaps if they're, you know, just so it is. I think it's a very gentle interpretation.
It's often, well, of course, we follow the clients, so of course we would ask questions. If they are asked to ask questions, we can ask them questions. So it goes that way.
Right, moving on. The installation of hope. So one of the things that brings people into a group is the belief and hope that the group experience will satisfy their needs. So all those people coming on your course will have a hope that the group and the experience of the group will satisfy whatever their needs are. Faith in the treatment mode, for example, in AT, can be therapeutically enhancing. So having a faith that what you're going to do is going to be beneficial because you've understood the basic concept of it and you're applying that to yourself and you think, oh, yes, I think that could be really good for me. So faith in the treatment method can be therapeutically enhancing. The therapist will reinforce positive expectations and recognize and remove, as far as possible, negative preconceptions and present a lucid, powerful explanation of the group's healing potential. Observation of improvement between members will confirm this. So in the group, everybody is working away. And although they're not explicitly saying all these things, this is happening because observation and comments that are in there. And we look at in a minute at how people perceive those and deal with them. Mm. So universality.
May I make a comment there? It's rare, but sometimes at the very beginning, people, I, one or two people over the years have said, actually, I don't know that I've got any faith in this. And my reply to that, because it's always early on, is actually it doesn't matter. You don't have to make this into a belief which has got to produce a result or depends on your practice, or it depends on a faith in it. You're here and obviously you're intrigued enough by it to do it, so let's do it. But let's leave out the possibilities that it might or might not work, because that's not really what Absolutely. We're doing either. Yes, yes. So actual faith doesn't actually matter. So
And it helped, but it can help. But in yes. actual fact, the fact that you're here.
Yes, that's the main thing.
If you weren't here, yes. you couldn't be doing anything. But you're here, yes. and let's work with what we've got.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yeah. yes, yeah. yes.
So universality. Many people think their problems are unique, that they have unacceptable thoughts, impulses, and fantasies. Social isolation heightens this sense of uniqueness, and disconfirmation of this in the group, recognizing that others have similar problems, can be a great relief. Mm-hmm. And so we have in the groups, you have people, and you don't necessarily know a great deal about their background and their thought processes. You have an idea of why they're there and some background, but not necessarily how they think and what they feel about themselves. And so going into a group, you can have a feeling of being, gosh, you know, so you're thinking, can I do it? Will I be accepted? Am I going to fit in? Will I get it? Am I any good? And most people are feeling that one way or another, to a greater or lesser extent, when they come. And as members perceive similarities within the group, it facilitates acceptance of themselves and others. And that's where the group is so brilliant. You come in as having all these feelings, you look around and you think, you know, everybody's all right except me. And then you begin to work and you begin to think that we're all the same. We have some unique features which belonged to you, but in actual fact, we're all coming from the same place. Moving on, altruism. When I see that word, I'm not quite sure that there ever is pure altruism. I think it's a contradiction in terms, that you can't possibly do something altruistic without getting some benefit for yourself. So I think it's an impossibility. What does anybody else think? You want to see what I mean? You can't do really good works without actually feeling.
Yeah, it feels too good, doesn't it? When you've helped somebody, or if you know you're doing something good, it feels too good to just be a giving thing. Yeah, because you get something too.
Sorry, Donna.
I was just saying, because you get so much from it as well. It's not doesn't feel like a pure giving. Like when I've helped somebody in counselling, I think, right, I've really helped you. I feel so good about that.
Because
I like the feeling of helping somebody. So it's not, it doesn't feel like I've just helped somebody, full stop. I've got something really good out of it as well.
So I think it's difficult to think of doing anything without having a feeling. I mean, we're not, if we're doing things for people for good, we don't do things for bad. We don't do things for horrible things, in which case you would get feedback. But so anyway, I rest my case. I don't think there's such a thing as pure altruism.
I think you're right there.
Always get something out of it, even if you think you haven't.
Yes.
So people recede through giving. Of course they do. Of course we do. We know that. And people give for all sorts of reasons, but it is a positive human quality. And you know, we have the saying, it is greater to give than to receive, which is probably right. Many people entering a group will have been ill, or certainly we know that, hospitalized, not working, and are demoralized and possess a deep sense of having nothing to offer, nothing to say, and nothing but interest. And I think that's right. I mean, let's face it, if I went into a group, I would be thinking those things too. I think, have I got anything interesting to say? You know, so on and so forth. So I think that's a very common thing. And the group experience can put them in touch with their inherent wisdom and innate value, which leads to improved self-esteem and confidence. People need to feel they're valuable and needed and valuable. Now, what actually I think what happens in our group is that out of the group, somebody who's been quite quiet and not said anything will say something really perceptive, really meaningful, which is recognized by the group. Oh, yes, and that's exactly what that means. So, and I think that in the group, people sit there and they all have this wisdom because they're actually responding to what's going on, but they don't necessarily have the confidence to say it. But people do say it, and when they do say it, that can actually set off an outlet for people to say what they do, and people are inherently wise and compassionate, and that's what happens within the group. A sense of life's meaning can ensue when we forget ourselves and become absorbed in something or someone outside ourselves. And again, the group gives the opportunity for that. Anybody want to say anything more?
I was just thinking of the first session I did with quite a big group recently, and somebody was there and didn't think that they could sit for the whole group and for the whole 2 hours, and it was going to be a long time, and how was she going to cope, etc. So I said the usual things. Of course, you can get up and walk about and go to the loo or do what you need to do, and we could lie down if you like. We've got some mats there and so on and so on. And then we got to the end of the session, and I just made the remark, right, well, we've covered everything I need to cover. What? She said, that was quick. And so that just illustrated that last remark, that she was, it went... She had voiced what she needed to voice, and then, of course, she was carried along with the event.
That reminds me of the business of giving people permission. That's exactly what you did. You listened and gave permission. I mean, there are people who say they've got a bad cough, and people say they've this, that, and the other, or they're going to have you're going to have a bad backache, or this is going to happen to me. So you say, absolutely fine. You cough away.
Yes.
That's all right. Do you see what I mean? Yes. The moment you give permission, it doesn't happen.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
When something is externalized and shared and understood and acknowledged, the force of it, the emotional content of it, becomes rested. And there isn't any emotional thing saying, oh, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, I can't do this. Once it's been acknowledged, then all of that is laid to rest. And this is something that is happening, and people are watching this happen. This is because without Jane saying, look what I did, I listened to her and nothing happened. You didn't need to, because people absorb that without being told. So all of this is going on the whole time. So moving on, the structure and methods, the styles of the facilitator. So there's the directive, facilitative, and non-directive. So the directive is imparting information, suggesting structure and response from members. Facilitative is the leader as a group member with more expertise in role and function. And non-directive assumes the group knows the purpose and is permissive of how to fulfill it. So let's have a look at that and think, what is the style of the facilitator, of the group leader, the therapist? What do we think about an AT therapist?
I think it's more directive, or maybe it has elements of all of it.
Absolutely. I think it does, yes.
I think it changes as we go along, because we start off teaching and with the knowledge, and they don't know anything. And then as we go through it, by the end of it, we both know it all.
Yes.
Perhaps not all, because they haven't done this course, but
yes,
they know what we're there to teach them.
And your therapist or facilitator always remains as the, let's say, group member, the person who knows more, even though all the group people have actually gained in understanding and expertise. They are not another facilitator. They are not another therapist.
No, of course not.
That just as I'm talking, I'm remembering incidents that I had. A man who was a therapist, and I can't remember what extra therapy it was. I think it was a meditative therapy, and he was very very much wanting to take the co-therapist role in the group, and so I'm thinking, you know, how to manage this, because he was using his own, what he did and what he did as a thing. And I'm thinking, okay, that's fine. So it was quite challenging for me to control, because he was a very strong character. And I think the way that he worked obviously was very good, but it was not appropriate for this to be part of what I was teaching in that. Mm. So what I did at the end, I asked him, when we'd all learned and we got to the last session, I asked him if he'd like to do a session of his stuff with us. And he did that, and it went very well. So I thought that was a way of acknowledging his expertise,
yes,
and his different way of doing it, and for the other people to be interested. Mm. And it really went very well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a lovely idea. I'm remembering someone who was like that in a recent group of mine, a woman who had obviously highly intelligent, studied everything that was wrong with her, but internet and the whole bit, and many, many other therapies. And then she would, every time I gave not an instruction exactly, but another explanation about what we were doing, she would butt in with, well, of course, in the da da da, and similar to what you've been describing. And actually, in the first session and the second session, she was a little bit like that as well. And I said, you know, actually, do you know what we are doing is autogenic? And I do appreciate all your wealth of knowledge on all these other therapists, but we really mustn't mix them up. We're going to get a little bit confused. And good for her. She really did listen and take it on board. From that moment and right the way through to the end of the course, she was a completely different person. So obviously, the word autogenic, I don't know what it was. And she got to the end and she had got so much out of autogenic, she couldn't stop saying how wonderful it was and how grateful she was and everything else. And it was a huge, big turnaround, actually. And I don't know how she managed it, because she was full of all her other knowledge, really full. I wanted to share it. And I think there was a little bit of wanting to put me down too, but that might have been my take on it. I don't know. Anyway.
Yes, so that just reminds us that there will be challenges to our role in the group, ourselves, the way we think, beliefs and views and so on. And we'll get to the disruptive behavior bit. But okay. In actual fact, it just reminds us that when you can see something starting that could actually snowball to something else, you need to try and, as they say, nip it in the bud. It is only fair on the rest of the group that you do something about this.
Yes.
We'll have a bit more of a talk about that, but there are things that have to be, and then you have to work out how you're going to do them.
Yes.
In front of the groups or publicly, or you're going to have a word afterwards and so on, or before.
Before we move on, Anne, may I just say that the non-directive style reminds me of the Quakers, where everything is silent, isn't it? And they know what they do, and they do it. And there is no leader, and there's nothing. I'm rather impressed by all of that.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. As Donna said, I think there's a bit of each of those. But it's not at the beginning. The bits sort of come as the group goes on.
Yes.
And then, of course, you've got the feeling of one group is absolutely fantastic and another group is not. And so you have to look at that and think how it's going to be managed, not only for your sake, but for the sake of everybody coming. So the tasks of the therapist, the creation and the maintenance of the group, that's your responsibility. Culture building and the activation of the here and now. And those are things that we do. We create, we form the group, we're responsible for it, beginning and starting. We're building the culture of how the culture within the group is going, and we're part of that. We're observing it, we're supporting it, and the activation of what's happening here and now. That's very good, because the here and now is a very good platform for the here and now of our experience of the practice. The practice is the here and now. It's not what we did, not what we did yesterday or tomorrow. It's not what we did 5 minutes ago or five we are going to do. It's the practice of actually what's happening now, what words are being spoken now.
Whether there's room in that first description, the creation and maintenance of the group, for the word well-being, creation, well-being and maintenance of the group.
Yes, that's your task, is for the creation and the well-being. Absolutely right. You know, you're responsible for how it's going, for their well-being. Yes, it's a very good responsibility, isn't it, Donna and Jane? The responsibility is not an onerous responsibility. It's a pleasurable responsibility. And I think because we know that what we're going to share, teach the people in front of us, has the inherent possibility of being something wonderful. And I always think it's like sharing my very best recipe for a chocolate cake. I want everybody to make one, because it's really good. A recipe for health and well-being. Okay. The creation and maintenance of the group. Initially, the therapist is the only known familiar person. So when they come there, but apart from very, very occasionally, nobody knows anybody, but they know you because they've met you. I'm sorry about this, but every time I get to that, it just tings off something I haven't thought of. On one group, I had two people who lived in the same street, and they hated each other. Oh, dear, oh, dear. That was funny. That probably happened once.
Can you remember how you managed it? I think we could all learn from this.
Do you know, Jane, I can't.
No.
Obviously, we managed it one way. Maybe I was only told that there was this hostility, but by one of them at some point. I don't think it was said in the... But they did say in the... Oh, so-and-so lives in the same road as me or whatever. And I think I did hear that there was a bit of hostility. But I don't think... I didn't have to do anything particular. Otherwise, I'd have remembered that. But
indeed.
That's the only time that there were two people who knew each other.
Yes.
Because initially, the therapist is the only known familiar person. Mm-hmm. And he is the group's unifying force. Yes. You know, if you're like the middle... of a wheel with spokes coming to the middle to relate to you. And at this stage, members relate to each other via the therapist as gatekeeper. As the group evolves, there will be more interaction between members. Now, the interaction bit is something that is, again, to some extent, the ethos or the energy of the group. But as some groups, nobody wants to particularly ever speak, but sometimes, well, usually they do. So the amount that people actually turn to each other and talk about things is limited, and usually that is self-limiting. In other words, you don't have to chip in and say, excuse me, but will you two not talk together, you know, like they did at school. So if you talk together, you're not to talk to your neighbour. It's rare that becomes a bit, but it can do if someone decides they get a certain relationship with someone and they've been talking outside in the waiting room and developing. And then particularly in this, you get someone who's full of good advice, full of good advice about what to eat, what to do, and all the rest of it. So, you know, you have to be aware of that. And it is your responsibility to limit, but also to allow.
Yes.
So to limit and to allow. And that's such a subtlety that you develop as you go along. And to some extent, about the whole ethos and the whole energy of the group and its participants. So these things come and go. And so in terms of the group, there need to be clear guidelines regarding confidentiality. We're very hot on that. A room for all members to be involved. Room for all members to be involved. Well, we are lucky. In the years that we've had the 80 groups at the hospital, I tell you, I have gone through some rooms.
Oh, you haven't, Anne. You have no idea now what we're like. Never mind. That's another story. Yes, certainly a lot of rooms. Yes.
Equality of time and attention. Now, that is, that again is a responsibility of the therapist. And, you know, it's like having a cake and we're all going to have the same slice. But occasionally, and depending on how the group's going on, there will be a time when one member has a thing that is acceptable to the whole group, that more time is spent on that person. And that comes up, and that's at the discretion and the experience of the therapist as to whether you can allow that one to go on. You recognize that that person has got this particular problem or particular whatever. And sometimes if you do that, it can become a learning thing for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
If you allow that, you actually get some information that is, or some suggestion from, or even from the person themselves, on how to move on. And that can be a benefit to the whole of the group. Recognition of members' behavior that threatens group cohesiveness, such as continuing lateness or absences. Now, lateness is it's a funny one at the hospital. There's obviously people who've got to get there, and some people come from miles around, and they have really, I mean, this is central London. They come from towns and villages and places, and then even coming from north or south, you know, it can take hours. And actually it amazes me. Do you remember Andrew Sikorsky?
I've never met him, but
he sent patients.
Yes, he did. Yes.
And they came from that place in
Kent.
No, it wasn't Kent. It was Wadhurst.
Wadhurst.
They've spent hours, and some of them had a day out in London.
Mm,
so
yes.
There's a whole, but the thing about lateness is that there's a certain sort of person who comes 10 minutes or 50 minutes, and they live round the corner. So you have to find a way of dealing. It's perfectly obvious, because you've just done the first exercise. They've missed that. One of the ways that didn't always work, one of the ways I would point that out, because you're not going to say, look, you're late again. I think I said something like, what is it special about 2:15 that's different to 2:00? That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, brings it up, because everybody knows this is a recidivist in terms of time. But actually telling people off, well, if you can manage not to. And then it also says it's a shame to miss the first exercise and so on and so forth.
Or worse than that, once they cottoned on that they may not speak about themselves for half an hour or something because, you know, it isn't their turn or whatever, then they will turn up just in time to do their own speech before they go. And that's a real disrespect for the rest of the group. And I think that does have to be acknowledged, and that, you know, that there's a bit of manipulation going on there, which can be. And you can see that the rest of the group are really getting a bit cross with it. And when this person turns up yet again 20 minutes late, it's actually the group themselves who will raise their, what shall we say, disquiet about it sometimes. So that's a good thing.
Has to be acknowledged. You know, you've missed some, you've missed all the really interesting stuff of the group and so on. So there are interventions that you can make. Subgrouping, that's an interesting one. That usually would come in the bigger, in the larger group, where you get two people who sit next to each other and begin to have another sort of a group of their own. Mm. It's usually two people, not three, and they will start ganging up. I think that's the thing, a sort of sense of ganging up. But that can be, none of it's easy. Scapegoating and disruptive behaviour. So those have got to be dealt with. And I think I've said this before when we've had talk about the group. There are some things that are terribly difficult to deal with, that I found terribly difficult to deal with, is smell. sometimes you have someone who comes with terribly strong perfume, and you get someone who's hypersensitive to perfume. What are you going to say? But the one that I remember, again, I'm sorry, this is me reminiscing about things. The one that I remember was this lovely man who I think lived in a hostel and he'd fallen on hard times. And he came and he was immaculately dressed, but you could see that his clothes were terribly old and probably from charity. Well, whatever, from charity shop. And he used to take his shoes off. And his feet smelled, because obviously he wasn't in a position to wash very much. And I don't know what on earth to do and to say, but it was quite obvious that there was this smell. And it was for him. I felt so sorry for him. I think, if I remember rightly, what I decided to do was at the end of a session, I kept him back and I said, it's lovely for you to take your shoes off, but no, sorry. I said, you've got, this pair of really well-polished brogues. And I think it's much better. You look much better with your lovely polished shoes on. Something like that. And I think that was enough. Yeah. So, you know, every now and then there's something that is difficult or offensive, and you have to deal with it, and or as best you can. So moving on, culture building. The therapist is an observer participant in the group, an observer participant. The observer state affords the objectivity necessary to make observations about what is happening in the group, but they remain immune from the process of change. Although members of the group may be entirely capable of commenting on and understanding the group process, comments will be more readily accepted coming from the therapist. However, comments and observations between group members has an authenticity which makes them very powerful. And that's what we love as we go on in the group. Yes, you know, we're the expert, but when they start coming up with that themselves about their own interpretation of what's been going on, this is really, really good work. The therapist must not hurry process to get results. Resistance, guardiness, distrust and fears in members must be recognized and allowed, working through with them, not avoiding or ignoring. Understanding the reasons for resistance leads to insight and reframing and the opportunity for real change. Well, I know you've done a whole session on resistance, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
It comes in all shapes and sizes.
Yes. Yes. And even the times when we are resistant, that could be a good resistance. It could be actually part of the process and all of that. So,
absolutely. Exploring the resistance probably gives you and everybody else further insights into what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Pia, have you just come back? Or have you been there all the time? Pia?
I'm here all the time. I'm here.
I haven't seen you on your screen.
No.
Oh, no.
No, it's... Yeah, I am here. It's just good. My internet is not so good. And I've nearly used all my data on my phone. So I have to be... So I'm just taking the video. I'm here. I'm listening to everything.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm here. Okay. Sorry. It's so rude not to be...
In individual therapy, the therapist is the sole agent for change. In a group, it's much, much less direct. Ideally, it's the group members who set in motion the therapeutic factors for change. And it is the therapist's responsibility to create a group culture which will facilitate maximal interaction. Now, one of the things there is the sleep thing. We have a lot of people coming because they don't sleep and have sleep problems. Or actually, in my experience, I think in all our experience, even if you've got pain or chronic fatigue or this or that or musculoskeletal, one of the things they say is they don't sleep well. So sleep problems are either the presenting complaint or one of the things that actually supports the experience of living with what they've got. And one of the things that's really noticeable is without actually setting off saying, this is good for sleep, without saying that at the beginning, but, you know, just starting off and recommended the standard practice and the standard this, that, and the other, what you have, probably two or three, you have people when they're giving the feedback that they slept better, they dreamt better. And this comes up quite spontaneously. And then that triggers off a whole sense of what's happening with sleep, which is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Because if you tell someone they're going to sleep better, of course they won't.
Yes,
but right. If you don't tell anyone, this is a treasure that they find as they're going along. An AT group may be considered to be too short and too structured to allow this sort of process to evolve organically. But there is immense therapeutic gain from listening to the accounts of how each member is handling the group task, that is, learning AT, as each member will engage in the task in the way that they engage in any new project. So that it's a wonderful example of how people take to new things. And I haven't mentioned, of course, in this thing about equal things, about the feedback that we give equal time to that. Everybody has an opportunity to speak, even those who don't speak, actually. And engage with the person who doesn't speak much as you do with the person who won't stop talking. So you're always sharing up the cake. The group, working in the here and now. The group is a social microcosm, we know, brilliant. And members have behave and relate to and behave as they do in their own lives. And that is absolutely obvious once you've started. You know, we've got the person who does this, the person who does that, the person, and so on and so on. So it's a microcosm. In the group sessions, the experience of the members is in the present, the here and now. Illumination of this process facilitates interpersonal learning, self-reflection, and the integration of the experience. That's quite a powerful thing, the integration of the experience. To integrate something is to take it in deeply and for it to become an intrinsic part of you. The therapist engineers the culture of here and now and facilitates feedback and understanding. In discussion between two people, the context is the explicit words used. In the discussion, the content is the explicit words used, the issues and the arguments. The process is the interpersonal relationship of the participants, the contribution of their agendas, how and why of the exchange, and this can illuminate all the way that people relate to it. So the words that you choose is the words, but they're chosen and used in the way that you relate to other people. Recapitulation of the primary family group. In many ways, the group process comes to recreate that of early family life for members. Also, the wider social experience of school or work. Interaction is reminiscent of interactions with parents, siblings, teachers, and bosses. And that's so very obvious in the group, that you've got someone who's, someone, you look at someone and you think, oh, that's just like a parent, or that was just like a teacher, or that's like my sister, or that's like my mother, and so on and so forth. The group there are in parental, the therapist evokes strong transience feelings from members. Few people are entirely free in their attitudes to issues such as dependency, parental authority, or God. Few people are free of any of the attitudes to issues of dependency. In the group, there are parental authority figures, siblings and peers, and there can be important revelations and strong emotions, deep intimacy, as well as hostile and competitive feelings. So really what you're doing in a group is having a little slice of life, just slice of life, a slice of family life, big meal round the table. In the group process, fixed roles and conflicts must be constantly challenged, and the testing of new behavior encouraged. There may be imitative behavior where the member tries on bits and pieces of other people and relinquish them if they don't fit. Once change, however modest, occurs, the member will appreciate that the feared calamity that their changed behavior may have engendered has not occurred. It has not resulted in death, destruction, abandonment, derision, or humiliation, and it can become a real part of them. So that's a really wonderful part of the group when someone decides to just take that step of taking on board something that they've been prevented from doing, not necessarily a thing or just an attitude or any of those things. Socializing techniques, social learning, the development of social skills may be explicit within the group process or more specific, as for example, preparing members for interviews, dating, or discharge from hospital. Well, we know that because on the group, we've got people who are going to have a new job or going to have this, or things are happening, or a new this, that, and the other, and that's the big thing. And we can actually have a group support of how they're going to face it and how they're going to do it, which is really rather nice. Or even if you've got to that stage, a personal affirmation about how they can manage this thing they've got, an interview, getting a new job, all of that. So that's where the group can be sort of coming together and collectively supporting someone and they can all join in that. Socializing techniques. Oh, I've said that. More indirect social learning occurs with open feedback within the group, from which individuals can obtain much information about maladaptive behavior. Not only does a small group provide a social microcosm in which maladaptive behavior is clearly displayed, but it also becomes a laboratory in which is demonstrated the meaning and dynamics of behavior. So this is why the group is such a wonderful, it's a learning process. It's all there in front of you. You haven't thought of this before, but actually you can see someone behaving like that. Oh, hang on there. And you can look and you can see someone behaving like that. Oh, hang on. Do I do that? And so on and so forth. And you're learning, interacting in this small, confidential, this little group, which is taken out of your normal life. You're not outside, you're not at the bus queue, you're not at home. You're in this protected little bubble where these new things are possible. Group cohesiveness. Successful group therapy is mediated by a relationship between the therapist and group members, characterized by trust, warmth, acceptance and empathic understanding, and is independent of the therapist's school of conviction. We know that. We know that all of those things, in actual fact, you know, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. We know that. The development of such qualities leads to group cohesiveness, which in turn leads to a sense of attraction and belonging to the group, good attendance, commitment, and a positive anticipation of the sessions. In discussion, there will be more participation and self-disclosure. The group's evaluation of a member may conflict with their own flawed self-evaluation. The more cohesive the group, the more the member will be influenced by the public evaluation of the group. That's an interesting one. So if someone is really quite out of order, there will be a sense of a unified expression of something. Either it might be something positive, it's more often perhaps something a bit negative. The more cohesive the group, the more the member will be influenced by the public evaluation of the group, to be accepted by the group despite a firmly held belief that one is ultimately unacceptable is very powerful. And that's really, really important. And I can think, and I'm sure you can too, think of people who have, I think of one woman, two people in particular, who have been to every doctor and every therapist, and they're said to be difficult and this, that, and the other. And somehow or other, they've sent to me, and what I have been able to do, because I was working in a one-to-one thing, I gave them it because they wanted to do this, and I felt that if they could do it, it'd make a huge difference to how they would then manage what they were working with. I offered them individual training, and with the individual training got to the point where I felt that they were well enough to join a group. So they joined a group, and it was really, really excellent. They were a participant, they were this, and it was really very rewarding. That this person was, who'd been sort of been told by everybody she was not outrageous, she was so difficult and untreatable and da-di-da-di-da. And she came to the group and she was accepted. She enjoyed it. She contributed. And that was exactly what that did, to be accepted by the group, despite the firmly held belief that one is ultimately unacceptable, is very powerful. And I remember that with a very good feeling in my heart.
Mm.
The acceptance of self facilitates acceptance of others and vice versa. So the last bit we've got is the challenging behaviour. How the members behave in the group will reflect how they relate to their interpersonal words. So the first one we've got, and we'll be familiar with this, is the monopolist. The monopolist rushes into the briefest silence, is anxious if silent, and always seeming to demand immediate and urgent attention. So we have plenty of examples of that. Now, this is interesting. The effect on the group is that after initially welcoming someone who says a lot, which you do, because if you sat with eight people in front of you, nobody wants to say anything. Or yes, I'm all right, or this, that, the other. You get someone who says, oh, this happened to me, and I don't know, give it a whole life history. It sort of is good, but of course that doesn't last. Who says a lot, the members will be soon feel frustrated and become hostile, particularly less assertive. The monopolist is unaware of the effect they're having on the group and often have little empathy for the issues of others. The therapist needs to deal with this member's need for attention and facilitate them being aware of the effect of their hogging. So here, there's the subtlety. First of all, you recognize that this person is like that in their life, and what a bore they must be. And it's not surprising that they're this, that, and the other, because they're like this. So here, I think, and Jane and Donna, you can also say, I think you cotton on to the fact that this person needs to be time limited and find a way of shutting them up so that everybody, so you have to do that. And there are practical ways. You can just at a point say, thank you, you know, thank you very much, mm-hmm. and make sure that you give the next person the same amount of time, mm-hmm. so that people are realizing that because that person has taken so much time, they aren't shortchanged. So this again is you like being a referee,
Can I make a yes. point there that if someone is interrupting a lot, I realized I developed a way of simply not looking at them at all and keeping my focus and face on the person who is talking at the time and just not acknowledging them at yes. all. That's when they've become a real nuisance, and that usually does the trick. It's quite yes. useful.
Because yes. when actually somebody does learn what they're doing,
yes.
that's great. That's why yes. they're in the group.
Yes.
This is this yes. learning of different ways of being mm. and mm. finding themselves more acceptable and being mm. able to get more out of it. And this is a wonderful thing mm. about people working together.
Yeah.
Variations on the monopolist are the narcissist, the one who experiences the world as existing solely for them. And yes, we've had a few of those. Difficult to treat with because they're even worse than the monopolist. Mm. And the clown, the person who cracks jokes, messing about, is sort of attention-seeking and jokey-jokey when they're not really jokey people at all. They're highly anxious and often very angry. And then we've got the silent member. Silence is never silent. It's behaviour. That's a really good thing. Silent is behaviour. It's difficult to know how much a silent member is benefiting by being silent. That's the wise old owl thing that you came across, Jay. How much are they benefiting by being silent? The reason for silence may be fear of disclosure, fear of breaking down, or losing control. So there's a lot of fear there. Fear of disclosure, fear of saying the wrong thing. Silent aggression, that's right, when you're all knotted up with aggression, stifles self-assertion, which is inherent and necessary for speaking out. So we know that person who sits there tight-lipped, and you know they're absolutely, you know, I'm never angry, you know, you look at it. So we see all these signs and what's in. The silent member may think they're boring. I think they have nothing interesting to say, inhibited, shy, bland, never taking risks, and avoiding any sign of aggression, they're left standing alone. Now, that being the case, The therapist can make a huge difference to that by their response to the feedback. Because with your silent member, you are going to, even if it's like getting blood out of a stone, you are going to give them the space, the encouragement, and the safety for them to say things. And then they begin to realize that what they're saying is, oh, yes, okay, let's hear a bit more about that. That, oh, goodness, well, that's very interesting, and so on, about anything. And bit by bit by bit, they will get some confidence and think that, oh, they have got something to add. And again, that is such a wonderful thing to watch as the group goes on, to see these changes in people. And then I'm going to finish with the help rejecting member. This is a variant on the monopolist. The member implicitly or explicitly is requesting help and then rejecting all suggestions, responding to why don't you with yes, but. So in normal conversation, we talk, you see, you have this thing, I can hear a but coming, I can hear a but coming, here's another but, and so on. They take pride in the insolubility of their problem, soliciting advice in order to reject it. This may represent an attempt to resolve conflicting feelings about dependency, someone with great unmet needs who anticipates rejection, depressive tendencies with a pervasive need to deprive others from pleasures they have been deprived. Their most powerful rejection is to reject the therapist and all the group experience has to offer, and to confirm to themselves and to everyone else that they cannot be helped. And because of this, help rejecting member presents one of the greatest challenges in group therapy. Amen to that. So I think that's probably so. Let's have some discussion or whatever. And
we've come to the end of our time.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But has anybody got any comments, questions? I would like.
I have a question. Go ahead, Jane. You said I would like. Go
well, I was only going to ask Anne. It's a slight sidestep, but I want to hear the poem again. I want to write it down. The wise old owl sat on an oak.
Okay. There was an old owl who sat on an oak. The more he heard, yes, the less he spoke.
Oh, that's it. The more he heard, the less he spoke. Got that bit, yes.
The less he spoke,
the more he heard.
The more he heard. Yes. Why not be like that wise old bird?
Why not be like that wise old... Thank you. I'm going to put that somewhere and frame it and so on. Yes. Right. Yes. Right. Thank you. Right. Sorry, Bev, you were going to say...
Yeah, I was just curious, you know, when you started working with groups, did you do any group training yourself, or did you gather your experience and your training from the actual doing of the group work?
Let me think where I started. I started in my general practice. I started in my general practice and ran my first group when I was... training to be a AT therapist, and they were all patients of mine. And I ran this group, and I didn't particularly think about group dynamics. I knew these people. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I didn't know how it would go. And I was doing a research project for a course that I was on, where one of the things that you're meant to do on this course was to do a piece of research, and I hadn't got a clue how to do a piece of it. But so anyway, and also this was the essay that I presented to the BS. It was Brian Davidson who was my supervisor, and so I killed two birds with one stone. And what I did, I wrote this up, and I got all the people who did the course to write up their experience. And I thought this was a good piece of research, because if everybody said it was rubbish, that's fair enough. That was an exploration. Everybody said it was a sub. Anyway, so that's where I started. Group. And then I began to run groups in the practice. And I mostly, I think I offered to the people I knew. And it just sort of developed from there. And then I was asked to take over the clinic at the hospital. And I have to confess, I never thought a thing about the theory of group, except I liked it very much. And the thing I particularly liked about doing autogenic training, which I believe in its effectiveness and its not just usefulness, its therapeutic benefits to patients. I as a GP was looking for, always looking for new approaches to treating people other than pills, which is why, and this was one of the first ones I got involved in healing. I did homeopathy, I did acupuncture, and put them all into my general practice. But the autogenic training was, I realized when I got going on that, that I enjoyed it so much, because the responsibility of what was wrong with someone or whether they were going to get better was not with me anymore. And I was able to be creative and flow, and also actually have soak up the two-way thing, which was the effect it had on me. So altogether, win-win. There we are.
Thank you and so much, Anne.
I miss running groups tremendously. Yes. I miss the whole thing. When I stopped at the hospital, I then ran a book club here where some of my favourite patients who I've known for years, who were like friends, first of all, we used to meet at the October Gallery for a few times, and then that was obviously running out, and so they wondered what we were going to do next, and I had to confess, the thing that I really, really, really wanted to do for many, many years was to be part of a book club, because my best friend and my best sister ran book clubs, and they're always going on about these blooming book clubs. And so what I did, I think, with seven of us, they used to come here, and we had this lovely, lovely book club, which lasted until the pandemic. Mm. Yeah, and that was lovely. Mm. So love the group. Mm. Yeah, that's done a lot to me. Mm.
Thank you so much. It's been absolutely fascinating. And do you remember, of course you remember, the little booklet we made of the history of autogenics at the hospital?
Yeah.
Would you like me to give some copies to Bev?
Oh, God, yes. Yes.
Sebastian, I'll make sure.
That's years ago we made that, you know.
I know, yeah.
I would have thought it was yesterday.
Yes, yeah. No, it's lovely.
And we bought all those stamps.
Yes.
I've
forgotten the stamps, but yes, yeah. We sent it out to loads of people,
everybody,
didn't we?
Yes. Oh, yes, I'd love you to do that.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I will do that. We have quite a lot left, so.
So, yes. And what are you doing next?
Next, we are doing a tutorial where they've prepared the questions. And so do stay for it. We're just going to discuss. Might be quite quick. It might be, I don't know.
Well, I'll stay for a bit longer. And then when we have a tea break.
Yes.
I'll leave then.
Well, we didn't have a tea break yesterday. We opted to move on and get finished so that Pierre can go to bed. So.
it's incredible to see.
Well, that might have meant so that we could all go to bed, of course.
I wouldn't mind having a bit of a shakeout.
Let's do that.
I'm feeling being sat on Zoom for the weekend. My body desperately wants to move.
I couldn't agree more.
Can I just say while we're... Oh, let me just stop recording this bit, actually.